Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a minute, how African-American teens are responding to Michelle Obama's stories of how she was called white when she did well in school. But first, the latest news about Pakistan. Thousands of Pakistanis are trying to flee the Swat Valley as the army bombards militants who've taken over much of that valley. The violence is flaring up as Pakistan's president visits Washington to appeal for more financial aid for the fight against the Taliban. Amir Ahmed Khan is the editor of the BBC's Urdu service, which broadcasts daily to Pakistan. He joins us from London. And Amir, you're in contact with people in Pakistan. What are they telling you?
We have been hearing all day reports of some really fierce fighting going on in the valley of Swat. Just a short while ago, the Pakistan Army spokesman told us that over the last 24 hours, they've lost 10 Pakistani soldiers in the valley who have been killed in this fighting. Another 9 were injured, while another 3 soldiers were killed in the neighboring district of Lower Deer. So it seems that over the last 24 hours, since the government stepped up its offensive against the Taliban militants in these areas, it has been a situation of continued and quite fierce fighting.
Well, and what's happening to the civilians? We are hearing from your other BBC colleagues that people are having trouble getting out of the valley because the Taliban is blocking the roads. Is there a sense that they are trying to keep civilians between the army bullets and theirs?
The army has in the past, we have heard the Pakistan army and other security officials accusing the Taliban of trying to use the civilians as human shields, and we may be looking at a similar situation in the valley now. We've heard that nearly 500,000 people have already fled from the valley, but thousands are lined up on the roads which are being patrolled. In many, many cases, the major roads are being patrolled by Taliban fighters, and other than that, the fighting seems to have driven away all the transporters from the area, so there aren't any vehicles to take the people out from the area. Pretty chaotic scenes, we are being told by the locals there that have been witnessed throughout the day.
Well, what about the timing? Do you read anything into the fact that the president of Pakistan is in the U.S. while the army in Pakistan is launching this offensive?
Oh, clearly, at some level, it is connected with the Pakistani president's visit to the U.S. Pakistan has been under a lot of pressure from its Western allies, and especially the U.S., to do more against the Taliban. But it's not just that. I think since the Taliban took over Swat and then they started to spread out into the neighboring districts, there has been a lot of concern inside Pakistan also, not just in the northwestern frontier province, but even in the southern, right down to the southern province of Sindh, where people have started to wonder how far does the government writ extend anymore. So it is as much for the U.S. And tying up with the Pakistani president's visit to the U.S. as it has as much to do with that as with the fact that a majority of the Pakistanis are quite seriously worried about what's happening in the northern parts of the country.
Well, we just want to touch on the fact that there were protests today in western Afghanistan after the deaths of more than 100 civilians Afghan officials say were killed by U.S. airstrikes earlier this week. The U.S. has apologized but not acknowledged yet exactly how those civilians died. But the president of Afghanistan, also in the U.S., give us your sense of anti-American sentiment in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, this has happened in the Farah province of Afghanistan, and we have been hearing that all day there have been rioting in the street. In the streets, we heard that about half a dozen of the people have been injured. People have stoned the government buildings. They've pelted stones against several government installations. At one stage, apparently, the situation got so bad that the government troops in the area, according to the local governor, Mr. Rasoli, they had to resort to aerial firing to disperse the protesters. But there has been no death in these protests. They're likely to continue for a few more days till the Afghan government or the U.S. government comes up with a more specific statement.
Amir Ahmed Khan, editor of the BBC's Urdu service, which broadcasts to Pakistan. He's speaking to us from London. Amir, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, switching gears, a recent USA Today Gallup poll shows that 79% of Americans approve of Michelle Obama's performance as First Lady, and she seems to be especially focused on young people. This week, she told students in Washington, D.C. about a new White House summer intern program specifically for largely minority D.C. public school students, and she warned them, in order to be a part of this program, you have to have your stuff together. And remember when she spoke earlier this year to students at a predominantly African-American underperforming D.C. high school.
Kids around my neighborhood would say, oh, you talk funny. You talk like a white girl. I heard that growing up my whole life. I was like, I don't even know what that means, but you know what? I'm still getting my A.
So how are young African Americans responding to Michelle Obama's message that school should be cool?
So next weekend, we wanted to have an outing to just kind of follow the Black History Trail.
On a recent Saturday morning at Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute, a couple dozen African-American high school students gathered around a long conference table to listen to two scholars. Today's topics, The Colony Strikes Back, African Protest Movements in Post-Colonial France, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as an International Human Rights Leader. Here, scholar Hope Lewis prods the kids with questions about King.
Can you tell me what kinds of risks do you think he was taking?
He could have risked alienating a lot of his supporters because he was directly opposing the government. It could have confirmed a lot of their fears of a black man having power and speaking out.
The program is called the Du Bois Society. It was founded by Boston activists, the Reverend Eugene Rivers, and his wife Jacqueline. We'll hear from them in a few minutes. And it was named after writer and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, the first African-American to get a doctorate at Harvard. Well, we convened a group of kids. You're going to hear from Gabrielle DaCosta, a junior at Oliver Ames Public High School in Easton, Massachusetts, Uchenna Nguro, who attends Milton Academy, a primarily white private school in the Boston area, and we start with Alicia Magnus Lewis, also at Milton.
I think that the Du Bois Society is just a special opportunity for me to gather around with people who share my culture, to read about the people who look like me in different parts of the country.
You know, I'm wondering, too, Obama's name was mentioned here, but it was Barack Obama's, and I'm thinking a lot about Michelle Obama recently. And how, you know.
my friends and I, we all got into really, really great schools. And my friend's mom was joking and said, oh, they see Michelle Obama, now they want all of you guys, so you could be the next Michelle Obama, or even perhaps the female Barack. So I thought that was really funny.
Is she a role model for you?
Most definitely. I mean, she
accomplished so much in her life just to see her. She's very influential.
And she's very educated. She had a very high-profile job, so.
She's been saying a lot lately, too, hey, kids didn't think it was cool when I wanted to be a good student.
Yeah, I actually watched a bit of that on YouTube, and I could empathize with what she went through. I mean, I remember in elementary school, it's like, oh, why are you trying to, you always know everything? Why are you studying all the time? Why are you reading all the time? My parents have sort of ingrained in me that education was important, and I knew back then I wanted to be a doctor, and I knew that if I studied hard and I worked hard, I'd be able to achieve that.
Did you identify with those words from Michelle Obama as well?
I could definitely identify with it. I know people who sometimes question why I'm always doing my homework and why I do the extracurriculars that I do, and it's because since I was younger, it was ingrained in me that I should work hard in school so that I can be successful. So I think taking what the people say to me about why do I work so hard, and I use that to push myself even more so I can do more with my life, you know?
Exactly. Also, a movement just starts with one person. We could be that one person who decides to study hard, and we'll hopefully convince more and more kids to want to study hard and be more invested in their future and their education.
Gabrielle, you had a lot of questions that you wanted to ask, and your hand goes up a lot. And, you know, we're hearing that it's hard for kids who want to ask questions and be good students. Is that true?
Yeah, it is, because there's sort of a feeling against it, especially in public schools, where it's cooler if you don't care and you cheat on the test or whatever and you don't really invest yourself in the material.
Do you think that that's something, it's being presented to us, I mean, the Reverend Rivers has spoken of this, and Michelle Obama has spoken of this. It's presented as something that's particular to African-American kids, that it's almost like a way of getting back at perceived discrimination that, you know, well, I'm not going to play the system. I'm not going to be smart and be a good student. You're nodding yes, because that's the white system.
I was actually nodding. I think I misinterpreted what you were going to say. For me, Raising my hand and understanding is a way of getting back at the perception that people have that I'm not educated. I know that I have an ability to learn and educate myself that my ancestors didn't have, you know, and I know that people will look at me and people who are my color and assume that we're going to act a certain way, and I want to be an example that that's not the way it is.
Well, but now you understand what I was asking, which is something Michelle Obama has said, which is that to do that is to join the system that has in the past or even now oppressed you. Well, you know what she said. Do kids ever say that to you? Are you trying to be white, which they said to Michelle Obama?
I guess you just have to let that roll off your shoulders.
Have you heard it?
I have.
Well, we wanted to bring in some of the guys in the Du Bois Society. Justin Conway is a junior at Beaver Country Day School, a private school in the Boston area. And we start with Zachary Torres, who goes to the private Lexington Christian Academy. I mean, just growing up, grade school, did you ever get feedback from other kids that it wasn't cool to be smart?
No, but in high school, there is a sense of how a black person's supposed to act, to like wear baggy pants, act hip-hop, not do that well in school.
You almost owe it to yourself to try to, you know, misprove misconceptions about you. You know, you're only the black kid there. You know, that's why they let you in. You almost owe it to yourself and to other people to prove that you're not just, you know, a number or a let in to add color to the school or anything like that. You're there because you are smart.
That can be kind of a drag, too, because it sounds like you're saying that you have to be better, which is another burden.
It is a burden, but it's also good for you because it motivates you to do well in school.
And the fact that it's Du Bois, I was reminded that he went to Harvard, and he famously said, "I was in Harvard, but I wasn't of Harvard." You're nodding. What does that mean to you?
It reminds me of the Langston Hughes poem, "America Never Was America to Me." Like, yes, you're here, but you don't feel like you fit in, or that the rights and privileges granted to Americans aren't necessarily for you.
Do you feel that, or do you recognize how he might have felt it?
Maybe not me personally, but I can feel it. When we talk about history in school, white history in America and black history in America is two different classes. And the African-American history just isn't really taught. So that could lead to feelings of not of-ness.
The other thing I noticed is that he kept all of his papers. He kept letters to everybody. And one of the things they have in his letters is the poster from 1885... announcing that he was the valedictorian of his high school graduation. Does that mean anything to you?
I think he kept it because it's symbolic of progress. And I think that we have a service to our history to educate ourselves, because there's so many examples in history of how knowledge is power. If you don't know where you come from, you don't know where you're going. If you don't know what your rights are, you can't utilize them. And then it's almost as if you have no rights. And just when we're here talking about all these things, I just feel like we're acquiring the tools we need to make a difference as we get older.
Some high school students in the Du Bois Society meeting at Harvard's Du Bois Institute. When we come back, the husband and wife team who started the group after their son was teased for doing well academically. And later today, Bernie Madoff's right-hand man talks. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been speaking with a group of Boston-area African-American high schoolers, members of the Du Bois Society. They gather on Saturday mornings at Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute to learn from scholars and mentors, kids who are now attending Harvard but were in the Du Bois Society as high schoolers, kids like Malcolm Rivers.
And I'm real good at this. All the stuff y'all thought y'all did, I invented. So please, make sure you do the background reading.
The Du Bois Society was founded by Malcolm's parents, the Reverend Eugene Rivers and his wife Jacqueline. Our visit was prompted by Michelle Obama's comments that black kids shouldn't be afraid of being smart, of being accused, as she was, of acting white. And we asked Reverend Rivers if Obama's comments and the creation of the Du Bois Society bring what was a private conversation within the black community out into the open and somehow may sound like a put-down of black students. And yeah, and you know what I'm saying.
There are, absolutely.
You know, well, some blacks saying, wait a second, you're saying that our kids aren't doing well. You're sort of underscoring something.
Let's talk. The W.E.B. Du Bois Society was created to address a problem that is indisputable, the black-white achievement gap. There was an insufficient emphasis put on intellectual and academic achievement within the black community. There needed to be an intellectual culture that was organized and focused. That's a reality. And Michelle Obama correctly identified a problem within the black community that has not received this sufficient attention. Listen, our son Malcolm was going to the Roxbury Latin School, one of the most distinguished academic institutions in secondary schools in the world. He was studying 7 days a week. And there was no intellectual culture or environment where he could meet other like-minded young black people, because at his school, he was told that his focus in academics meant he was white. And this kid was raised in a black neighborhood. So my wife, Jacqueline, said, we're going to fix this. We came home. My wife was upset because of the loneliness and the level of isolation that Malcolm was feeling, because he wanted to get good grades and he wasn't going to let the dudes who wanted to do fake thug hip hop, you know, rhetoric deter him. And so there is a real problem which the Du Bois Society has sought explicitly to confront.
Even though that might make other African Americans a little uncomfortable laying the blame at their kids' feet for holding your kid down.
Well, listen, look, the reality is that there is a long overdue conversation within the black community around values, discipline, probity. Barack Obama caught heat when he went to the Pentecostal church during the campaign and said, black fathers, no excuses. And he got up and told the black community, we cannot make excuses when black men produce babies and then abandon the mother and the child. That can't happen anymore. And the Du Bois Society is explicitly created to say, we're going to solve a problem and stop making excuses.
I should add, because we know you well here in the Boston area, it's not that you're going to let the powers that be off the hook if, in fact, schools that are primarily black aren't getting the funding they need. Absolutely. I mean, there are other issues, too.
Listen, racism exists. We do not live in a post-racial America. We've improved dramatically. And the United States is the greatest country in the world. Fact. Now, we recognize that we've got to deal with inequalities of opportunity. We've got to deal with an absolutely horrific structure of income inequality. Then, in addition, there are cultural questions. And the Du Bois Society is addressing the cultural question, which ultimately comes on the black community. These black parents of the children that attended the Du Bois Society tell their children to turn off the television. Do your homework, and you've got not only do your homework, but you've got supplementary reading that you've got to do for Saturday morning. And these parents get up early in the morning, bring their children here as they are challenged to intellectually engage. And when you've got Harvard scholars lecturing high school students to do supplementary work, that's an extraordinary achievement.
Jacqueline Rivers with her husband, the Reverend Rivers, co-founder of the Du Bois Society. What do you think is happening with the African-American kids who say to other kids like your kids, what are you trying to be white if you try to be academically proficient? What is happening there? What are they saying?
I want to suggest that it's not always as explicit as kids saying you're acting white. I think sometimes it's a subtle expectation. I think it's an identity that kids are invited to adopt. Identifying with street life, identifying with a hip-hop identity, which is not at core about academic excellence, which is not to say they can sometimes go together. I'm not familiar with as many alternative identities for white kids. And I think that there is a kind of anti-intellectualism which prevails both for black kids and white kids, but it seems to me that it's more extreme in the case of black kids. Another factor I'd add, I think that black kids also face a kind of subtle expectation from even teachers within schools that a C is okay when you're a black kid, whereas it might not be okay if you're white. Nothing explicit and nothing deliberate, but a subtle expectation.
Do you think something, too, that could be happening is that these black kids who might say that to other black kids who want to achieve, you know, maybe they're rejecting a culture that they think has oppressed them. Maybe they're rejecting an education that excludes them because they don't learn about black history. But maybe they're also afraid. Why try? Because I think I might fail.
I think all of those factors are going on. I do think there's a sense of fear that goes with this. Kids know that they're not expected to do well. Kids know that in the society, blacks are not seen as high achievers. And I think it's easier to not try.
Obviously, the Du Bois Society is looking to change that thinking, not just by the talks, but by the fact that these kids are surrounded every Saturday with the elders, like people like yourself and these professors, and they're seeing that it's entirely possible. But just your thoughts on what the Obamas are doing to sort of change the paradigm.
I think the impact of Barack Obama has real potential, not just because he's the first black president, but because he has the kind of academic background he has, that he was president of Harvard Law Review, and that he pulls it off still being very much having a black identity, a cool black identity. Says to kids, there's a way to be black, a way to be cool, which doesn't mean you have to turn your back on academic achievement.
That's Jacqueline Rivers. She and her husband, the Reverend Eugene Rivers, founded the Du Bois Institute, a leadership program at Harvard that encourages young African Americans to become scholars. Well, still ahead today, they call Bernie Madoff's right-hand man the ninja. What does he know and what is he telling prosecutors here and now? After the stock market closes today, the Obama administration is expected to say that all of the 19 big banks that have taken stress tests have received passing grades. But leaks of that news yesterday sent stocks into what one reporter called a euphoric burst. And Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner told Charlie Rose last night that the results will be, on balance, reassuring. So what happens now? Rebecca Christie is Treasury reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us from Washington. And Rebecca, you've told us that we're probably going to hear that many of the banks are healthy enough for now. They won't need government money for now. And at least a handful of the nation's largest banks, including Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, will be given 6 months to become healthier, to raise billions of dollars on their own. So start there. How will they do that?
The banks that will be told they need capital will need to meet a target for a particular kind of capital, which is called tangible common equity. Actually, that's a ratio. It's tangible capital is what the regulators are looking at for the first time. And this is different from Tier 1 capital, which is a broader measure. I know it's a little technical, but it's something the regulators look at most of the time.
It is confusing. So let's dig deeper here, because tangible capital, that I'm assuming that means, you know, cash, things you can get your hand on. And you point to preferred stocks versus common stocks, and that a lot of the banks may be transferring some of their preferred stocks to common stocks. So let's start there. What's the difference?
Right. So preferred shares don't have voting rights, and they sort of occupy a middle ground between debt and regular common equity that investors have, which comes with voting rights and other things like that. So if a bank converts preferred shares, which can be held by private investors and which also are held by the government right now, most of the money that the government's put into these banks has come in the form of preferred shares. If they convert that into common equity, it improves their TCE ratio, and that in turn gives them a better grade, if you will, on these stress tests.
This is the tangible credit. But because preferred stocks, we understand, are paid back first. Let's say if a bank should fail. That's sort of the string they come attached with. That's why they're called preferred. They get paid back first. And as you said, it's not quite a loan, but they expect they're going to get paid back. Whereas a common stock, you know, it is more cash than a loan, and common stocks are way in line behind preferred stocks before they get paid back?
Yes, in a bankruptcy. That's a decent way to think about it. You can get into the details and the lawyer stuff pretty quickly, but in terms of trying to think about how these things are listed on the bank's balance sheets and in their capital holdings, that's a good way to keep it straight.
Well, Rebecca, that's confusing to some of us, because it sounds as if a lot of these banks, you know, as you said, they're going to move assets from the preferred stock column to the common stock column, which will make it look like they have more cash because it's not considered at all to be debt. But isn't that just switching pots?
Well, as part of these stress tests, regulators are looking at TCE for the first time. They haven't focused on it that much before.
Again, this tangible
tangible common equity. Yeah. You'll hear a lot about TCE ratios from stock investors. And they're doing this because a large part of the goal of the stress test is to reassure investors that they know what they're buying. They know what kind of shape these banks are in. So regulators are looking at the same measures that investors have been looking
at. Well, if common stock is better for banks because it shows up as, you know, cash, and it's better for these regulators and analysts because the bank looks healthier, you mentioned that the government has a lot invested in the preferred stock. So isn't this now riskier for American taxpayers? Because if we move the government money from preferred to common, then that suddenly is riskier for stockholders. It's not the preferred stock anymore.
Well, government officials would tell you that they're doing this for the long run. They're doing this to keep the banks in the best long-term shape that they can. And so it's not a question of any sort of short-term losses they think they're exposing to. It's what they believe will lead to the best long-term outcome.
Right. And as you said, really actually knowing what's where. Rebecca Christie, Treasury reporter for Bloomberg News. As always, we thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, back in just a bit, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. The veil of secrecy may be coming off Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Madoff was sentenced, as you know, to 150 years in prison for scamming investors out of billions of dollars. But so far, he's taken all the blame. His secretary, Eleanor Squillari, now says others must have been involved and that Madoff once told her that his wife, Ruth, kept a close eye on the books. Well, Madoff's secretary isn't the only one talking. Frank DePasquale, Madoff's closest associate, is cooperating with prosecutors. James Bandler of Fortune magazine is covering that story. And James, tell us more about Frank DePasquale. You call him Madoff's chief lieutenant. What did he do?
Well, he's a very mysterious figure. He ran the investment operation for Madoff on the 17th floor of the Lipstick building. Completely fraudulent. There was not ever a single trade, legitimate trade made on behalf of a customer, at least for decades. And DePasquale is in a position to know who was involved in the fraud, who wasn't, help investigators understand sort of the chronology of the fraud, and really how this worked. And until recently, he hasn't spoken. Now it looks like he's trying to make a deal with prosecutors in exchange for providing information he would hope to gain a more lenient sentence.
Well, flesh him out a little bit more for us, because while we shouldn't judge people by their appearance, his might have made people at least curious about him early on. He didn't look like any kind of investment banker.
Well, this was a guy who grew up in the Howard Beach section of Queens, a tough neighborhood, a tough-talking guy, high school education, no experience in, you know, Wall Street or formal experience in investment management other than working for Madoff as a young kid. He was someone who sort of flitted around the other operations, the legitimate operations, in a way that some folks described him as the ninja. He was sort of here, there, but you never knew really what he did.
Came to work in pressed blue jeans, boat shoes, and a sweatshirt, and this is Wall Street. I mean, he must have stood out a little bit.
He stood out, and people who talked to him, you know, he was a pleasant guy. He would talk about fishing. He loved fishing. But folks would always say we just didn't really know what he did.
Right. Well, some people had to know what he did because he interacted with investors. And you're writing that his testimony could be very condemning for some large investors. Why?
First of all, what he is willing to say is that he helped Madoff give special deals to certain investors. If the investor had other investments, big gains in other investments, and needed to get a tax loss, he would suddenly give the guy, write the guy up, poof, a tax loss. Who knows? That could be seen as tax fraud.
Well, let's be absolutely clear here. You write that DePasquale would receive phone calls from investors who would literally say to him, look, I'm doing so well in other arenas. I'm going to get really hit at tax time. Can you give me a loss? And he would. Now, that sort of implies that they could give him a gain, too, that they were manipulating it.
This suggests that investors had reason to think there was something untoward in Madoff's operations. Not necessarily that it was a Ponzi scheme, but that this was, say the least, unorthodox.
So there may be claims of cooking the books, but you say others might be happy by DePasquale's testimony. Why?
Well, one of the biggest assumptions that the public has had, and even employees in the firm, is that the family members had to know. This was a family operation. This was a firm where Madoff's brother was basically the COO of the firm, where Madoff's wife would come in at times to work on reconciling checkbooks. And there's been an assumption that these guys had to be involved, they had to know. Well, what's interesting is DePasquale is saying he cannot implicate these individuals, the family members, in the fraud. And what's interesting about that is he has a high incentive to deliver the biggest scalps he can. And the fact that he is unable to implicate the family speaks in some ways to his credibility.
Well, how do you square that, though, with what we're hearing from Bernie Madoff's former secretary? She was with him for 20 years, seeming to imply that Ruth Madoff had to know something about the scheme. The secretary tells a story, and I'm going to paraphrase it a bit here, but it's a small talk she was having with Madoff once when they both learned that the secretary of a client had embezzled. And Madoff said, well, you know how it works. You start out taking a little bit, maybe a few hundred, a few thousand, you get comfortable with that, and before you know it, it snowballs into something big. This is what his secretary says he said. But then, she says, he surprised her by going on to say, but that couldn't happen here. That's why I always had Ruth watching the books. Nothing gets by Ruth.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really an interesting statement, but I think also, you know, we should be a little cautionary about DePasquale. What he's unable to do is to say these family members were involved in the fraud. He didn't see them on the 17th floor a lot. He can't say what they knew or didn't know.
Well, the Boston Globe is also reporting this week that bankruptcy trustee Irving Picard, this is the lawyer charged with settling out all of this, that he sent these so-called clawback letters to Tremont Group Holdings and the Greenwich Group. These are two big investment firms that funneled their clients' money into Madoff's investment fund. Together, they claim to have lost about $10 billion. Now, we understand that through the clawback letters, Picard is trying to get back some of the fees that the companies got for funneling the money to Madoff, as opposed to trying to get back interest that was made on investments. It's just about the fees. But do we have any sense that the groups themselves are going to be named by DePasquale?
Well, DePasquale, he is not going to implicate Fairfield criminally. I think his position was these guys were well-meaning and duped.
Well, what do you think the next shoe to drop in the Madoff case is?
I think one of the next things we'll find out is whether or not DePasquale gets a deal.
Is it clear whether or not we, the public, will hear those names?
Yeah, I think some of these names are going to surface.
That's James Bandler, covering the Bernard Madoff case for Fortune magazine. James, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, we have time for just a few of your thoughts, and we heard from many of you after we noted in our swine flu news roundup that Jay Severin, a Boston talk show host, had been pulled off the air because of language he used to describe Mexicans that his station deemed hateful. Then we listed some of that language, which we're not going to do again. We'll link you at our website. But suffice it to say, it's not language that we usually use, and a lot of you were upset. Joan Perkins writes, you know, I love the show, but that wasn't up to your standards. And Gretchen Sommerfeld of Arlington, Massachusetts, agreed. She writes, it just sickens me to hear the vile things repeated, and I can't even imagine how I would feel if I were Mexican. Repeating slurs just gives them more staying power. You've even reported on that. But Fred Bates of Derry, New Hampshire, represented another point of view. He writes, by quoting Severin, you inform those in the public radio audience who would otherwise be unaware of the depth of hatred. Hate dies in the sunshine. Thank you for turning over a rock so we could all hold our noses and dry some toxic lies. Well, we also heard from quite a few of you on a different topic. Synesthesia, the rare medical condition that has a genetic link and causes people like Sean Day to conflate their senses. For example, to see colors when they hear certain sounds.
When I hear piano music, I see in front of me a large cloud of sky blue mist.
Well, several synesthetes gathered on our comment page. Carol Daly writes, my husband has always talked about how all the letters are colors and how the nuns in Catholic school used to poo-poo him. I think it's a beautiful thing, and now we know why. Isn't science great? And Mayor LaTouche adds, I tuned in just as the cloudburst movement from Grofe's Grand Canyon Suite was being played, and Sean Day was saying what colors he heard.
Okay, timpani's way down low. Whole bunch of very dark blackish smoke. Low brass is sort of a reddish orange flames.
As I listed off the colors I heard Mr. Day list off the same colors. What a hoot. I loved it. I really do feel that it's like having your own pair of 3D glasses. Well, we'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on comments. You can join a discussion or click on contact us to call or write. Back in 1 minute. Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. In her much-loved books, The Interpreter of Maladies and The Namesake, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri mined the divides that often open up between Bengali immigrants from India and their American-raised children. She stayed in this vein in her highly acclaimed best-selling collection of short stories, Unaccustomed Earth. The paperback was just released in April and is already number 4 on the New York Times trade fiction list. In this excerpt, a young woman named Sudha tries to understand why her parents refused to acknowledge her brother Rahul's drinking problem.
Her parents had always been blind to the things that plagued their children. Being teased at school for the color of their skin or for the funny things their mother occasionally put into their lunchboxes, potato curry sandwiches that tinted Wonder Bread green. What could there possibly be to be unhappy about, her parents would have thought. Depression was a foreign word to them, an American thing. In their opinion, their children were immune from the hardships and injustices they had left behind in India, as if the inoculations the pediatrician had given Sudha and Rahul when they were babies guaranteed them an existence free of suffering.
That's author Jhumpa Lahiri reading from her collection of short stories. We spoke to her about the book when it was first published and asked about the title, two words taken from Nathaniel Hawthorne, Unaccustomed Earth.
They're just two beautiful words, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
I was rereading The Scarlet Letter some years ago, and I was working on this book, and just was stunned and struck deeply by those words and by the passage in which that particular phrase appears as really expressing so beautifully and succinctly everything I had lived, everything I was writing about. I think in a way it could be a title for everything I've written and everything I hope I'll write in the future.
Let me read a little of Nathaniel Hawthorne's words. He says, human nature will not flourish any more than a potato if it be planted and replanted for too long a series of generations in the same worn-out soil. My children have had other birthplaces, and so far as their fortunes may be within my control, shall strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. Oh, it's just beautiful. Your unaccustomed earth was, what, Rhode Island?
Rhode Island.
How much of your writing is about you and that experience?
I think all of my writing is coded versions of that experience. They're never my experience directly. I hide behind characters that I invent or put together from other people, and I keep going through it. I think I keep reliving that experience of my parents, their arrival, my upbringing, that collision, that uncertainty, that yearning for feeling rooted and falling short.
Well, so interesting because, like Nathaniel Hawthorne, I bet your parents thought, we are going to give our child the best possible new soil, you know, instead of the soil of India that's, you know, been over and over and over again used. So when somebody does that for you, you can't be unhappy.
Well, they did it, and yet I don't think they ever embraced it in that way. I think there was always a doubt. There was always a worry. There was always the awareness of so much regret and loss and sacrifice that this new soil came at a great cost.
Hmm. And in this new book, you've written that since becoming a mother yourself, you've said that that gives you insight into what your parents felt. But can it really? Because you have a completely different experience from your mom.
I do, and I did. But I think once you have a child, it does enable you to understand the experience. It certainly makes me appreciate so much more how my parents lived and raised us with so little support compared to what I have. We were related to nobody in the entire United States. And to raise children in that type of isolation is something I can't imagine for myself, but they did.
Well, and you do imagine it in some of the stories. I'm thinking of the first story. Maybe you're exploring some of those family ties unaccustomed earth. And it's a young mother who has moved way across the country to the West Coast. She's raising her children at home. Her mother has died. Her father is coming to visit. And part of her is thinking, oh, you know, is he going to want to live with us now? And suddenly something is revealed and she realizes, well, he actually has a life of his own. What am I feeling there in that moment in that mother?
I think she's understanding her father for the first time and in a way loving him most deeply at a point where she realizes he not only doesn't need her in terms of being taken care of, but that she needs him but can't have him. So it's sort of a loss of a parent, more symbolically, I suppose.
Yeah. In a trio of stories that close the book, you have two children of Bengal immigrants who were thrown together when they were young, when the families were thrown together, and then they separate and live their lives, and then they're thrown together again as adults. We've been talking about how the children of Bengal immigrants react to their parents. What are you saying about how they interact to each other in that story?
Well, I think one of the things that I have grown increasingly aware of is the way in which my own social life really differs from the social life of my parents, and the fact that 99.9% of my parents' friends were their friends for a reason, and the reason was that they were also Bengali.
Yeah.
And that was the reason. It made for a very homogeneous world within a world social life for them, and by extension for me when I was very young. And then I grew older and I went to school and I started having some school friends who were usually not Bengali or not even children of Bengali immigrants. And I realized as I got older that friends meant a different thing and do mean a different thing to me. I think those stories are, you know, the two characters in those three stories have led a life in which there's almost a resistance to someone from their parents' world simply because the person is from their parents' world as opposed to their own. And yet they do find each other at a time in life where, because that older generation is now growing older, dying off, there's a sense of that world disappearing. And so they are attracted to each other again, or for the first time. Well, actually, she's attracted to him when she's 13.
But, yeah.
You know, it becomes a more mature, albeit temporary, connection between them.
Yeah. Do you see yourself in the future writing, you know, placing a family born and raised in Colorado and having no Bengali heritage? Do you see yourself writing in, you know, completely different characters?
I don't. I mean, you know, I write about what inspires me to write. And this is what inspires me to write and continues to inspire me.